Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
Well, it's Wednesday the 20th of April and this is Reconstruction from the Construction Index with me, David Taylor, and Phil Bishop here to discuss some of the recent comings and goings in the UK construction industry. Good morning, Phil.
Morning, David. Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm okay. I've thrown off, I think, the hideous cold I had last week.
Oh yeah, that was a bad one.
I've had a good long weekend doing some useful things and some completely unuseful things. But all good.
I understand that you are actually laying bricks at the weekend. Is that true or is that just a rumour?
Yeah, an outside set of steps is falling apart and I've put some bricks, laid them carefully using
good.
Skills I didn't know I had. My wife is saying, don't try and do it yourself. Let's get someone in who knows what they're doing. I can do it. And she came out and went, blimey, I never knew you had it in you.
Well, there we are. There you are. Second string to your bow, Phil. Right. Well, you know, we never stop learning, which is a perfect segue into our first topic of discussion today, I believe.
Indeed. The first thing I think we'd like to talk about is the call from the Chartered Institute of Building in Northern Ireland for the development of a construction A-level, which is, I mean, it's not a big political issue, but the CIOB in Northern Ireland have produced a manifesto timed for the local elections, the assembly elections that are coming up next month in Northern Ireland. And most of the things they're asking for is things that people always, you know, construction industry always wants: stable policy environment, long-term strategies, blah, blah, blah. But this very specific call is for ring-fenced funding for the development of an A-level in construction. And I thought, what a good idea. There is already a... you and I, of course, want to call them O-levels. They're not a GCSE in construction. It's been around a few years. It doesn't seem to be a big thing in England. I couldn't find an England-based examination board, doing a quick Google, which has a GCSE construction.
Oh, really? It's just an Irish thing, is it?
Well, the Northern Ireland exam board, CCEA, and the Welsh exam board, WJEC, they both have a syllabus, which I could find online.
Okay.
And I had a look, just at the Northern Ireland one, I had a look at a past paper for the GCSE, and it's actually quite good. It's sort of thing I'd have fun sitting that exam myself. I mean, I looked at a past paper and then the marking scheme, and I thought, oh, okay, I would need to have some lessons to be taught the language of what the exam required. So it had a diagram of a building and said, what sort of building is this? What sort of structure is this?
Okay.
And I thought, well, it's a building. It could be a house, it could be an office, but it's a building. You know, it's not a bridge. So, you know, my answer in my head is it's a building. They went on saying, you know, what materials might this be made of? Name three. And, you know, discussion of the founder. Anyway, it turns out that the correct answer was it is a cellular construction.
A cellular construction.
A cellular
okay.
construction.
Right.
Which is a particular bit of terminology that wouldn't have occurred to me without having
No, you
having
need to be
done.
Taught that. Yeah.
Yes. But the actual exam paper I thought was quite good stuff and interesting. How can I put it? I mean, an awful lot of what we learn at school, and I'm thinking of Latin here, is completely useless, except it teaches you how to learn and how to process things and apply knowledge and so on. So it's the difference between doing a crossword puzzle and baking a cake. If you bake a cake, at the end of the day, you've got a cake. If you do a crossword puzzle, you've got absolutely nothing. You've just, you know, passed the time and exercised your brain a bit, maybe, but for no useful purpose. And it strikes me that if we learn construction at school in this sort of fairly academic way that these GCSE papers have suggested, it has the same benefit of using your brain and applying learning and so on as learning Latin and something useless like that. But with something much more useful at the end of it.
Yeah. I don't suppose the CIOB has sort of come up with a draft syllabus. I mean, that's presumably asking a bit too much of them. But I'm assuming that if somebody's at A-level, is thinking of going into construction, they'll be doing something like, if they're going to, they might be going on to be a structural engineer. So they might do maths, physics, and stuff like that. Or they might be going into business, in which case they might do economics or business studies at A-level. But presumably, they're talking about something more than just sort of a little bit of physics, a little bit of maths, a little bit of business studies. They're talking about something a bit more specific about the practical application of construction. Do you think?
Yes, I mean, I do. It's not, when you say practical, I don't think they do. I mean, the GCSE level, and I would assume that the A-level syllabus work to be developed would take that as a starting point and move it in a, you know, higher direction.
Yeah.
It's not asking people to mix cement,
no,
or carve a piece of wood or whatever, or wire a plug. For example, one of the questions is, what three precautions must you take before fiddling with electricity or something like that, you know?
Okay, yeah.
So it's more, I suppose, on the one hand, theoretical. And on the other hand, the project work that they're doing, even at GCSE level, is, it's basically BIM. It's computer-aided design. It's creating models. And I don't mean physics, I mean computer models.
Yeah.
I think I went looking for the GCSE building syllabus expecting to see blocks of Lego, and it absolutely is not that. You know, it's much higher level than that, and much more useful. And the point is, it's not just treating construction as joinery and bricklaying or, you know, tiling and plastering or whatever. It's treating it, the whole built environment. In fact, the Welsh exam is called Construction and the Built Environment, and it is paving the way for not even trades. It's not even saying, you know, do this exam and you can get a trade. It's more aiming at preparing young people for a professional level or a managerial level, whether it's site manager or architect, structural engineer, whatever.
Well, this is what CIOB says that you said in your story that the A-level will help schools and career services realise that this is an industry of professions as well as trades. And
yes.
I think that's probably quite important.
Yeah, I think that's why this ignorance among schools, teachers, careers, counsellors and so on, that they do think of construction as an industry of trades, not as an industry of professions and professions. And that's why it tends not to be promoted as something for bright people to go into. You know, bright people go be a doctor or an accountant or something, and, you know, little Tommy in set G can go and work on a building site, which is not what we want schools to be doing at all.
No, that's absolutely right. And there's a huge sort of gap in the middle there, isn't there, of, as you say, the managerial skills which people need. I mean, yes, I know plenty of people who have gone to university and done engineering and are engineers, or have gone to university and studied for years to become an architect. And so you've got, you know, got those professions at one end, and then you've got the scaffolders and bricklayers at the other end, and all that stuff in the middle is being completely overlooked. So I think probably an A-level that looks at construction in the round is a very good idea. So I was slightly surprised, actually, that because I did know that there was a GCSE, I was a bit surprised to discover that there wasn't a construction A-level. I thought there might be. I mean, you can go to college, I suppose, and do an MVQ and get an A-level equivalent qualification.
It's a BTEC, I think.
It's a BTEC, sorry. Yes, BTEC. So I was rather surprised that there wasn't one, but I do think there's definitely a need for it.
It's like so many things. I mean, I would have loved to have learnt more practical stuff at school. I mean, I said I was laying a few bricks and I wouldn't begin to think about building my own house, but a little diddy retaining wall in the garden, I think, okay, I can figure that one out. But there's so many things at school which we should be taught and we're not taught. I mean, maybe it's expected that parents will teach us how to wire a plug and put up shelves and these sort of daily life skills, but I don't know. I mean, what do you wish you'd been taught at school and weren't?
Well, those life skills, the ones you mentioned, the everyday skills that you sort of pick up, you acquire sort of almost incidentally. I mean, important things, personal finance, how to manage your own finances, you know, how to go about applying for a mortgage, you know, how insurance works, stuff like that. You can't avoid it. You're going to have to deal with it, grapple with it sooner or later. And for some people, yes, it's a no-brainer. It's very easy. Other people struggle with it. And I think those are skills that we really shouldn't overlook. And we shouldn't sort of consider them to be things which you just sort of pick up on the way. When my kids were at school, they did something called PHSE, personal, I can't remember what it's called now. But anyway, that was basically all about sort of life skills.
PHSE, that sounds like personal hygiene and sex education.
Yeah, I don't know if it was. Yeah, it does sound like that. I don't even know if I've got the acronym. It's not an acronym, but if I've got the initials correct. But it was something like that. It was a bit like, I think it was a sort of a secular religious studies sort of thing. It was, if you like, all about, you know, how to be a good citizen, that kind of thing. But even then, they didn't get taught the sort of things which I think they should be. In fact, my kids have said themselves that they wish they'd been taught about how to get a bank account, you know, stuff like that. Just things which you need to do, but you know, you have to figure it out for yourself.
See, I think the personal finance education should be disguised. I don't think there should be, you know, right, now we're going to teach children how to get rich. It should be disguised within maths lessons. If you remember, all your maths questions, you know, at a certain age were, you know, you've got a pie and you've got 12 people, but John's twice as hungry as David, and David's vegetarian, and Katie isn't, or whatever, and you've got to work out how to share up the pie between these people so that everyone's happy. Now, what they ought to be doing is the maths textbook, maybe they are, I don't know these days, but the maths textbook I would have liked it to have been, it would be more useful to me if it's been, you want to buy a £200,000 house, you're earning £20,000 a year, the bank says that you've got to have such and such a deposit, compound interest rate of blah, you can have a repayment mortgage or an endowment mortgage, work out what's the best bet and how much you've got to go ask mum and dad for.
That would be a great way of doing it. I mean, turn it into a sort of a practical conundrum rather than just sort of, you know, the nuts and bolts and the numbers. I suppose in a way that's what sort of pre-O level, that's what maths was like. I can still remember, just about remember pounds, shillings and pence, and really struggling with the fact that there were 12 pennies in a shilling and 20 shillings in a pound and all this sort of stuff. I was absolutely delighted when decimalisation came along. But that was all that sort of stuff. You know, Johnny goes into the sweet shop and buys 6 ounces of bullseyes at sixpence halfpenny for a quarter of a pound. How much are his sweets going to cost him? That sort of thing. So I suppose it's a similar sort of thing. It's a practical conundrum. You've got to work it out.
It's your six-year-old version of getting a mortgage, isn't it? Getting a bag of purple's eyes.
Yeah, but there's definitely a place for that sort of practical education, I think, even in the A-level syllabus. But so what A-levels did you do, Phil?
Well, I did do maths, and I can't remember. I mean, I remember I did maths A-level. Now, I do remember, you know, differentiation and integration how you could use it to calculate the space under the curve or the space under the, you know, under a bell or whatever. And I know that's what it's for. And I can't for the life of me remember how to do it or what I would do with a sine, cosine or tangent now. I do remember probably only about 11 years old, using trigonometry to measure the height of a tree. Which was very fascinating. You know, go outside, see a tree and say, right, we're going to work out how tall that tree is and then do it ourselves. And that was a real sense of achievement working that one out.
Yes.
So I remember that vaguely, and that's to do with sine and cosine and things, I believe. But in terms of the differentiation and integration, not a clue.
No.
And I suppose the thing I use every day, which has stuck with me from arithmetic, I mean, it's much lower than A-level math, was percentages.
Oh, yes.
You always know that in your head, if you're trying to work out 75% of 343, you know in your head that the right answer is going to be a bit, you know, half it and add half again. You know, it's going to be...
Okay,
you know,
yeah, roughly, all right.
You're looking for an answer somewhere around 240 or something like that. And if you get the answer 3 or 7,000, you know it's wrong. So yes. Then you get your calculator and you do your sums. So I suppose from school, you learn the sort of number you're looking for and then you go find it using a calculator. Yeah. I wouldn't do pen and paper anymore.
Well, that's right, yeah.
But the one which I still have struggles and huge domestic arguments about is the whole thing, question of odds. Now, it seems to me if I buy a lottery ticket, my odds of winning the lottery are whatever they are. Let's say they're, you know, 1 in 20 million.
Yeah.
Now, to me, if I buy 2 lottery tickets, I must have doubled my chances. The odds must be 1 in 10 million. That just seems to me common sense. But
you think so?
My wiser and better educated wife has forever explained to me it doesn't work like that.
No, if it did, you would only have to buy a couple of hundred quid's worth of lottery tickets to be absolutely certain of winning.
I think it goes further.
Believe me, I've tried it. No, I haven't. Really. No, I haven't.
but it just seems to me that if you, I mean, I know rolling a dice 1 in 6, roll it twice, and it's 1 in 3. You know, whatever. So I apparently don't think I have a problem with odds, but apparently I do. I'm all over the place on odds, so I steer clear of that, which is why I don't bet.
You don't bet? No, neither do I, for the same reason. Well, I started off my A-levels doing pure maths, applied maths and physics, and realised pretty quickly that I'd chosen the wrong 3 subjects. I just didn't know what to do. I'd been guided by a well-meaning careers teacher who said, you know, we'll always need engineers, David, so go and do that. And I realised I wasn't going to be an engineer if this is what it took. So I switched, and I decided to, instead of doing subjects which I thought would be useful, I did subjects which I enjoyed studying. So I ended up doing English, music and metalwork.
Oh, something practical.
So something practical. So I was, when I say metalwork.
So you can make your own trombone.
Well, there was a little bit of sheet metal work, but it was mainly fitting and turning. So in fact, my A-level project was to make a drilling machine. So that was been absolutely no use to me. Well, actually, it's not. True to say, it's been no use to me in my career, because it has helped me understand a few technicalities in the construction industry. But really, I've no practical use beyond that. I still have a lathe. I've got a screw cutting lathe, which I don't really use because I very seldom need to use it. But you know, it stayed with me, and I still enjoy doing that sort of thing. But I did find that when I wanted to go to university, the university admissions people considered that I only had 2 A-levels, not 3, because metalwork was not considered an academic A-level. So it was completely discounted. It was ignored.
Is there still a metalwork A-level? Does that still exist?
And there probably is. There probably is. I don't know.
It seems extraordinary we'd have a metalwork A-level, but not a construction and built environment.
Yeah.
Because I can see that metalwork would be deemed not academic.
Yeah,
but equally, I can imagine that university admissions tutors might consider construction not academic. But
well,
it's surely as academic as geography, for example, and I would imagine, you know, perhaps would overlap with geography quite a lot in terms of the whole, you know, the collision or the synthesis of the built environment and the natural environment and the interaction of it, the exploitation of natural resources and raw materials. I mean, I remember very young age in geography learning about it was all based on old empire. My geography, it would be terribly. It was all about cocoa and rubber. I don't think that would be the way things are done these days.
Well, no, things have moved on, that's for sure. I mean, I would be surprised if, I mean, I say it was metalwork, the actual A-level was craftwork brackets metal. But I was saying it's mainly machine work. There was a reasonable amount of metallurgy involved, not an awful lot. There was a lot of design.
But this is before computers, of course.
I
suppose people who previously did metalwork then did computers because they thought the metalwork,
yeah,
they were the only machines that existed. And then we realised better machines existed. And people now do computing.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But I think now that there's been a huge change in the whole sort of university environment, hasn't there? When, you know, we only had a relatively few universities back in the day when you and I went to university. You know, there were polytechnics, which are all now universities, and lots of further education colleges, which now also offer degrees. And you can get degrees in all sorts of things. I mean, I know of somebody, I'm sure, who did a degree in surfing. I'm sure you can do a degree in surfing somewhere down in the West Country. But anyway, so I'm sure that metalwork wouldn't be considered not an academic subject anymore. But again, that simply strengthens the rationale behind introducing an A-level in construction. I mean, it's a solid subject. There's a lot of stuff to learn, and it's very specific. And as you say, the skills which you need in construction may not be taught in any A-level courses at the moment.
And had I done an A-level in construction, even if I hadn't then gone on to have a construction career, I'm sure that I would have learnt things, which we were talking about earlier, would be handy for me. My you know, being a homeowner, someone who's got a garden to look after, the general run-of-the-mill DIY things that I would know what wall not to knock down.
Yeah. Well, yes, it'd be useful just for that. That's for sure. Yeah. So, I think that I think the CIOB are absolutely right to push for this, and I would certainly back them up. I think it'd be a worthy qualification.
I agree.
Right. Okay. Well, that's that subject. Should we move on to something else, Phil?
Well, it leads on rather well, I think, our next topic, doesn't it?
It does indeed, because, I mean, talking about school leavers going into construction, having said that it's not all about trades, a lot of it still is, of course, not everything is off-site these days, there's a wonderful new documentary series on BBC Three, which I'm sure a lot of listeners will probably already have discovered. And I only discovered it yesterday, as it happens, and it's appropriately called Brickies. It's on, I'm not actually sure when it's on. Do you know, it's on Thursdays, isn't it?
It's on Thursday evening, 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
It's on BBC Three, which is now back on air, which is the young person's channel.
That's right. Is this series angled mainly at young people? I suppose it probably is, but I think it's very enjoyable for anybody who wants to watch it. It's I think there are several gangs of brickies involved. They're all employed by a Derbyshire firm of builders and bricklayers working on various projects. I've only watched the first one, Phil, and that was about a gang of brickies working on a project up in Stoke-on-Trent. And it was interesting. One of the things which really struck me was how nice all these people were. They're a really nice bunch of people. And I was going to say a nice bunch of blokes, but they're not all blokes. There's at least two girls involved. They all seem to treat each other well. They all seem to be having a really good time. They're all good mates. You know, you hear a lot about on-site banter and bullying and, you know, the things that people really don't like to acknowledge at site level in construction. And yeah, there is a fair amount of banter, but it's good-natured banter as far as I can tell, and most of it seems fairly harmless, although there's a bit of, you know, throwing trowels around, which probably shouldn't be encouraged. But I think it actually paints quite a positive picture of life on site. And these people, they love their job. They love their job. They say they're earning good money, and they just want to be successful brickies, and I think that's great.
Well, you told me about this program. I hadn't heard about it. When you told me about it yesterday, I thought, I will go, what? I thought, if you're going to watch episode one, I'll watch a different episode.
Okay.
And there are only six, and they're all on iPlayer now. If you don't have to wait till Thursday evenings to watch it, you can go to iPlayer and find it. It's just called Brickies. And I picked at random episode five because the blurb mentioned something about dealing with shortages on site.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, well, that sounds interesting. And I kind of feel like the existence of this programme is the best thing about it. I wasn't quite as... I felt it was a bit made in... I mean, I don't watch Made in Chelsea either, but I do watch Gogglebox. It's my insight into the TV that I don't watch. And I suppose being old and boring, I wanted it to be more about bricklaying rather than about the people themselves. And it's not. It's about the people themselves.
It is,
who
yes.
happen to be, you know, laying bricks. I think the biggest selling point for it, they do seem like potential, role models, I guess. I mean, you said they're all seem like good, solid young people. But more than that, they talk about in this particular episode, they reckon £500 a day earning potential on a good day. If you have I think they're paid by the brick, and if you have a nice straight run and the weather's fine. But of course, the weather isn't always fine. If it rains, you have to quickly cover up your work and hang fire. And when the material didn't arrive on site, there's just a lot of hanging around. So I kind of had the impression that amidst all the banter, me being me, I was kind of thinking, get on with your job. Get on with your work.
Well, they can't if nobody's delivered the mortar.
But when the bricks were there to be laid and the mortar was there, I suppose I became interested in the individuals, and I suppose if you start with episode one, you work your way through, like any of these programs, you invest in the characters themselves, and no doubt they all have a journey and all have an arc.
Oh yeah, of course, yeah. Well, they have to. Yes, wouldn't be telly if they didn't. But no, the episode which I watched, you know, introduces you to them, and they talk to camera, obviously individually, about their job, about their aspirations, and about each other. One thing which really struck me about the first episode was that there was just one girl in this gang of, I can't remember how many of them there were, four or five, working on this particular site. There was no otherness about her. She was simply a member of the team. And they did ask her about her boyfriend. And there was one lad who was teasing her, saying, "Yeah, do you think I'm sexy?" And she just turned around and said, "No." And obviously they acknowledged the fact that she's the one female on site. But there's no stereotyping and there's no teasing or anything like that.
Well, not on
camera. I don't know whether if the team went away that they would that things would change. I doubt it though.
I don't know if it's the same the people I saw in the episode I watched are the same people that you saw. But similarly, there was the young woman bricklayer was certainly didn't get any jip from the lads because she was quite clearly as if not more competent than any of the blokes.
Oh, really?
and that came across. I mean, maybe it was in the edit. I don't know, but she appeared to be, as or more competent. And the if you like the vulnerable one was the apprentice who had just split up with his girlfriend, and he didn't quite know how to. He had to be shown certain things, certain techniques of his accounting for the first time.
Yeah.
But what was rather nice is on this particular job, in a place called Heeg in Derbyshire, which I've never heard of Heeg before.
No.
But this girl, Georgia, was working with her dad on this job, Merv.
Oh, that's right, yeah. She was the one who was in episode one as well, yeah.
Okay, so it's Merv and Georgia,
Welsh
father
girl.
And... Father and daughter working alongside each other, which I suppose would inhibit any boisterousness.
That's true. You'd have to deal with their dad. Yeah.
But that was a lovely relationship, and there was no inequality, I guess, in the workplace relationship. They were just getting on and doing the job together and enjoying doing it.
There was it's interesting you should say that about Georgia, because in episode one, are we giving away spoilers here? I don't know how much to say about it, but there was a little episode in it's a bit in episode one where some work had to be redone. The foreman came along and I looked and said, "No, you need to take that down and do it again." And it was a bit of work that Georgia had done, and I thought, uh oh. You know, is she going to be, you know, a girl did this sort of thing. Is she going to be ribbed for this? But they were, no, the foreman phoned her up after work because she was, you know, she was very disappointed that this had happened. But he phoned her up after work and spoke to her and told her that, you know, she was one of the best bricklayers on the team. He didn't want her to worry about this. She came to work the next day absolutely beaming because, you know, she'd had a pep talk, which I thought was great. You know, it showed you a little bit more about the dynamics on site and basically good site management as well. And I was quite impressed by that as well. And another thing which struck me about all of them actually was that yes, they enjoyed the job. They're outside. It was it was a good crack and all the rest of it. But they're all very motivated by earning potential. Georgia wants to buy a new car and her boyfriend comes up from Wales and takes her out to test drive a new car. And, you know, she's delighted with it and all the rest of it. And, that's their motivation isn't entirely money, but it is a big thing. They see bricklaying as, you know, a career for life. And this is the way they're going to make their money. It's not just, oh, I need something to do. Let's go and work on a building site. They see themselves as on a career path, and I think that's also a really positive observation as well.
One thing that struck me, the site they were working on in the episode I was watching, the ground underfoot was appalling. I don't mean muddy. I mean it was like a bomb shelter rubble. It's like something out of John Borman film Hope and Glory that they're having to clamber over. And I think if I was running that site, I might have, maybe it's not possible, but I think I would have wanted to sort of level out the area, not the platform they were building on itself, but the approach, walking backwards and forwards from the from the material stockpile to the actual wall they were building, was hazardous to say the least. and I was quite surprised by that. I would have thought health and safety might have had a word.
Well, the BBC will get irate emails from health and safety consultants about something like that. But this is a warts and all, isn't it? If that's what it's like on a site, that's what it's like on a site. I mean, you've mentioned in the past, we sometimes get snotty emails from people saying you shouldn't have published that photograph because it showed somebody working wearing the wrong gloves or something like that. Well, in this show, there are people carrying bricks without any gloves on their hands. That's what happens on site. And, you know, you should be wearing the right gloves. Everybody acknowledges that, but it's real life. And sometimes people cut corners or they forget or they don't bother. And maybe it's the same with site conditions. You know, if people are walking backwards and forwards over a pile of rubble all the time, as long as they can do it often enough without falling over, then perhaps they'll just leave the rubble there. Maybe it only gets shifted if somebody trips.
What I particularly like about this series, we've discussed some of these TV programmes in the past. Do you remember the Ainscough crane gang?
Yes.
That was followed. I mean, that was interesting and showed real life in the crane industry, warts and all, and the working conditions that those guys put up with. And I found that interesting. But this is particularly focused on, it's a BBC Three programme, on the young people. I mean, they're all, I mean, what are they, between 18 and 25 or younger, I guess?
Guess younger, yeah, because some of them are apprentices.
Yeah.
You know, so they'll be school leavers, and the oldest is probably no more than 25, I would have thought.
Apart from Dad Merv, who we see in episode 5.
Oh, yeah.
but it shows it from their perspective, and I hope that some people will think, ooh, most young people who start off on building sites do so with the motivation I think of, I want a new car, rather than, I want to learn how to lay bricks. Hmm. And that's true, I think it's true of most people going into work. I mean, we'd all much rather, I say all, most of us would much rather win the lottery than have to work for a living. It's a fact of life that we need to work for a living to, you know, pay bills and get on.
Yeah.
But these people are successfully doing just that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how typical this particular company is, and whether they've, you know, for the purposes of BBC documentaries, have mixed up the teams so that they've got people from a diverse mixed heritage background, and are these token women in the teams, or do they normally work there? But the fact that there are at least two women working on separate teams in this series, I think, is significant. We get a lot of stuff about women in construction. It's one of those sort of perennial topics which everybody complains there aren't enough women in construction, aren't enough racial minorities in construction, all the rest of it, which is true, and I wouldn't deny this, but you can only complain about it so many times before actually something you do something about it. When people talk to me about women in construction, very often the people they hold up as exemplars are the engineers and the architects, the people who, have gone to Cambridge and done structural engineering, or they've studied architecture, and these are people who visit sites just to see how other people are getting on with their work.
And have you seen they lifted the pencil of a mouse?
Well, exactly. And that's fine. That's fine. And there are some incredibly impressive women in construction at that top level. We seldom see them at the site level, though. And this is, I think, where this series also scores, because the fact that we are seeing women doing site-based work for a change, and that doesn't always come across in the conversations I have with people.
I think the bottom line is we need more everyone in construction. There are shortages of young people coming into the industry.
Yeah.
And don't exclude people on the grounds of sex or race or whatever. I mean, let's make the industry appealing to everyone, so that we're fishing in the biggest possible pool.
Well, absolutely, yeah. And seeing girls hold their own against the boys in a program like this, I think is obviously giving a good signal. Talking about schoolboy humour. We could talk about schoolboy humour, Phil, because we've got an ideal opportunity to do so, and we don't often do this on Reconstruction. But you and I both received an unwarranted press release.
Unsolicited.
Unsolicited press release.
It might have been warranted. Should we examine whether it's warranted or not?
Well, yes, let's do that.
I think this is where we're going to lose about at least 30% of our listeners, possibly more.
Well, it wasn't our fault. I mean, we didn't ask to be sent a press release by a manufacturer of sex toys. But, you open your inbox and there it is. You've got to read it. Normally that goes straight in the bin, but I did read this because they mentioned buildings. You've got to square that particular circle, and it's not very easy. It was a company called...
It's a company... I don't think they're a manufacturer. I think they're a retailer. It's called...
Oh, right, okay, then.
Mega Pleasure.
Mega Pleasure, there we are. Yeah,
I mean, if you need their products, I'm sure you can Google them. We're not on commission here, folks.
No.
No Mega Pleasure dividends for us. But it's a clickbait listicle that they send.
Yeah,
I'm not doing this. But it's headlined, "The World's Rudest Looking Buildings, Which Will Make You Double Take."
Yeah.
And I thought, I'm not wasting my time. And the first one says, in the lead up to the FIFA World Cup held in Qatar, football fans from all over the world are getting a laugh out of the Al Janoub Stadium. And I thought, I don't know that stadium. So I Googled it.
Mm-hmm. And what did you find?
Well, they did, because this press release they sent in didn't have any pictures with it, because presumably that would involve paying money for image
copyright,
and so on. But listeners, Google Al Janoub, Janoub Stadium in Qatar. You'll probably see it on telly during the World Cup. France played their first game there on the 22nd of November. So if you're watching France play on the 22nd of November, they'll Match of the Day or ITV, whoever filming it, will probably have an aerial shot of the stadium.
Yeah.
And it's the aerial shot that you need to look at, because apparently it's designed to look like a traditional Qatari dhow boat. One of these.
Is it? That's the idea. That's
what it's supposed to look like.
Okay.
But the particular form of petals and the geometry and the pink luster to it, apparently, said some people make it look like female genitalia.
Yeah. Yes, indeed.
And I don't think you need to have a particularly smutty mind to think this. I've shown it to a few people and I said, what's that? And without fail, they go, oh my God!
Yeah. Yeah.
So it is quite extraordinary, particularly when you think of a country like Qatar with its fairly strict religious observances. It's quite surprising. What did you make of it?
I have to say that I don't know who designed it, but they were really inviting this sort of Finbar Saunders, double entendre sort of thing, this sort of laughing up your sleeve and sort of sniggering response to it, because it's very easy to say that looks just like a whatever you want to call it. But not being content with that, of course, this is just a start. Mega Pleasure have listed several other buildings around the world, which they also say resemble...
Naughty bits.
Naughty bits, basically. Some of which possibly do, but a lot of them, I think you've got to be really quite filthy-minded to actually see. There's a water tower, for example, and I think if anybody's got a... that looks like that, they need to go and see a doctor. It's the one which I do think is a real architectural faux pas is the Asahi Beer Hall. It's the headquarters of Asahi Breweries, which that must be Japanese, by the east bank of the Sumida River. It was completed in 1989. And... it does look as if it's got a golden turd on the roof. And there's no getting away from the fact. I think it's supposed to look like a flame. But
I don't see that. I see it's Mr. Whippy on his side. It's not like one of those sort of joke shop, sort of curly-whirly...
Dirty Fido.
Dog-doos.
No.
it's almost one of those cycling helmets that the Olympic... velodrome cyclists wear, sort of
much elongated. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, another one which is included in the list was the Gherkin, 30 St Mary Axe, which is a very well-known landmark in the City of London. Apart from being generally tall and narrow, and I suppose by default phallic, as indeed all high-rise buildings, they can all be accused of being that. I didn't think that it was especially rude in appearance, but apparently, and they would know, Mega Pleasure would know, it resembles a bullet vibrator. Well, I mean, that's a specific item of kit, and you either know what one looks like or you don't. And until I visited their website, I didn't know what one looked like either. And there was another one, artist Paul McCarthy's Christmas tree.
But does Gherkin, hang on, now you've done your research on your homework in the spirit of journalistic inquiry, can you report back that the Gherkin does in fact look like a bullet vibrator?
I suppose so, yeah. In general, sort of, it looks more like a bullet than a bullet vibrator. I mean,
I hope it's bigger, though.
What the oh yes, the building, yes, definitely, yes, several thousand times bigger, I would say. No, I mean the Gherkin doesn't look like a Gherkin; it looks like a bullet. And I suppose a bullet vibrator looks like a bullet. Therefore, you can make that connection. But again, you've got to have a pretty dirty mind. This Paul McCarthy Christmas tree, which was an inflatable sculpture installed in the Louvre in Paris, or outside the Louvre in Paris. Yes.
I'd never heard of this. I had to read it twice because I thought it said Paul McCartney. The Beatles,
yeah, I did. I've never heard of Paul McCarthy, but he is an artist.
McCarthy,
TH. Yeah, yeah. It's big, green, roughly conical structure. I mean, big, 20 meters high, something like that.
Looks like a hedge.
Well, it's supposed to look like, in outline, it looks like, you know, a Christmas tree. Get a kid to draw a Christmas tree. It's basically a triangle with a stem and a plinth at the bottom.
Or a wine bottle stopper. You know, when you fail to finish your wine, you can't put the cork back in. It's one of these wine bottle stoppers that you put in the top.
Yeah, it's a bit like that. Now, this looks like something called a butt plug, apparently. And a butt plug, and I'm sure that I don't need to describe what that is or explain. And until I visited until I Googled it, I wouldn't have known, and I really must get out more, because there is an uncanny resemblance, and it resembles this thing. I mean...
It was not for long, though, this Christmas tree in Paris. It was in October 2014, to put it in. And apparently the prisons were so shot, it was inflatable, and they're so shot, they popped
They went and punctured it. They went and popped it. Good for them. I tell you one thing, having Googled all this, we're getting back to a little bit back to construction, perhaps, here. I was thinking about designers. And I thought, you go to university or art college and you study product design or industrial design. And then you go and get a job designing things for people to stick up their bottoms. How do you explain that to your friends and family? Very strange. I suppose it's a good career like anything else. But yes, so apparently if you've got a dirty enough mind, you can see filth in virtually every building. There's a listening station somewhere in Berlin.
The Duffelsberg. Yes. Near Berlin. I'm sorry, that I mean any schoolboy would have to giggle at that one. That is plainly, that's exactly what Andrew Coppleston used to draw on my exercise book behind my back all the time. And I didn't discover it after the teacher hit me over the head with the books. I didn't know that Coppleston had drawn it on there. It's a white cylindrical tall shaft with a golf ball on top and two big golf balls either side of it looking. It is.
Fair enough.
There's no other way around it.
Yeah. Okay, fair enough. It makes you look at buildings in a slightly different slant, I think, after reading something like this. But I certainly think that probably the Al-Janoub Stadium, getting back to our original rude building, was perhaps a bit of a mistake. And maybe, why didn't nobody point it out? Maybe they felt that it would be indelicate to point something like this out to their client, especially in such a sort of straight-laced society such as Qatar. But somebody should have said something, I think.
Right. Where do we want listeners to send their letters of complaint, David?
I think they should send them to Mega Pleasure, actually. I don't want to get them. We're only reporting. We don't make the news.
We do hope we haven't offended you, people. But occasionally, it is necessary to explore the outer corners of construction. We'll be back onto more savoury topics next week. We promise.
Yeah.
As ever, we don't know what it will be. But for another week, unless, David, you have any other business?
No, I think that's all, Phil. I think we've done a sterling job today. So
thank you. Once again, for listening, everybody, with apologies this week to our sponsors for letting the side down. We'll behave better next week. But thank you very much indeed for listening to David and I. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.